Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the May 7th, 2021 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a, looks like a 1940s era convertible going down a highway. Looks like it's one of those wide open scenes out west. At the driver's wheel is President Joe Biden. He's looking at his passenger and smiling and just having a good old time. And his passenger is Franklin Delano Roosevelt in his characteristic monocle with his cigarette in the holder. And he's smiling back at Joe Biden. And the headline is Grand Ambitions, Biden's $6 trillion plan to rebuild America and become the next FDR. That is, in fact, our first main story, and we'll start right there. Biden's big pitch for his own New Deal. What happened? President Biden marked his first 100 days in office this week by unveiling the $1.8 trillion American Families Plan, the latest in a $6 trillion package of bills that seek to reshape the U.S. economy and the role of the federal government. In a speech to Congress scheduled to take place after The Week went to press, Biden was to outline and promote the provisions of the bill, which would expand access to education and child care and pay for it by boosting taxes on the wealthy. The bill would provide 2 free years of community college, universal pre-K classes, and $85 billion in need-based Pell Grants for college tuition. It would earmark billions for child care subsidies, extend child tax credits for most parents, and create a federal family and medical leave program. Biden proposes to fund it by raising the capital gains tax rate from 20 to 39.6% and the top marginal income tax rate for high earners from 37 to 39.6%. He also wants to raise $700 billion over a decade by increasing the IRS budget by $80 billion to root out tax evaders. The sweeping bill comes on the heels of two massive spending packages that together make up the most progressive agenda since Franklin Delano Roosevelt enacted the New Deal 9 decades ago. The $1.9 trillion pandemic relief bill passed in March provided billions for poverty reduction measures, direct stimulus payments to most Americans, and state and local relief. Last month, Biden unveiled a $2.3 trillion infrastructure bill that would allocate billions for rebuilding roads, bridges, and railways, and would also extend broadband across rural America, build affordable housing, and provide billions for home care for elderly and the disabled. Now, after just 100 days, I can report to the nation, America is on the move again, said Biden in an excerpt from his prepared speech. We have acted to restore the people's faith in our democracy to deliver. Biden's new package got an immediate thumbs down from Republicans. President Biden ran as a moderate, said Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, but I'm hard-pressed to think of anything at all he's done so far that would indicate some degree of moderation. What the editorial said, Biden is selling a radical agenda, said the Wall Street Journal, and he can thank the pandemic and Donald Trump for giving him an opening. He's benefited from being the calm after the 4-year Trump storm and from the inevitable post-pandemic economic lift. Instead of using that leverage to unify the country, as he promised, he's governing like Bernie Sanders and pushing a spending blowout unseen since the 1960s. Yes, Biden abandoned his pledge to build bipartisan consensus, said the Newark Star-Ledger. But the reality is he had little choice. Republicans are playing the same game they played with President Obama, trying to deny him any success, even on measures with broad public support, like infrastructure spending, pandemic relief, and gun safety. Biden was elected to get things done, and if that means doing it without GOP support, then so be it. What the columnist said. Biden is poised to match FDR's stunning debut in office, said Jonathan Alter in the New York Times. Taking office amid a devastating pandemic, he faced the same task Roosevelt did during the Depression. Restore faith that the long distrusted federal government can deliver rapid, tangible achievements. With a $1.9 trillion relief bill and a vaccination campaign that's delivered more than 200 million shots in 100 days, Biden has proved himself the first president since Lyndon Johnson who can rightly be called FDR's heir. Biden's drive to make himself the next FDR is monumentally arrogant, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. Have ridden into office on the unpopularity of his predecessor and a once-in-a-hundred-years pandemic, the promised uniter now claims a mandate to change America as rapidly and irreversibly as possible. It's not confidence that drives Biden's government expansion, said Matthew Continetti in CommentaryMagazine.com. It's dread. With just a 218 to 212 Democratic majority in the House and a 50-50 Senate, Biden knows he may have just 2 years to hand out trillions in subsidies, entitlements, and other goodies before Republicans regain one or both chambers. He's trying to go for broke now, even if it means future generations will have to clean up the mess. Biden's first 100 days have already reshaped America, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. His pandemic relief package could cut child poverty by more than half, has expanded Obamacare, and has the economy vigorously rebounding. To the frustration of Republicans, Uncle Joe's vanilla ice cream bromides and refusal to engage in splashy public fights have enabled him to avoid stirring up the angry conservative backlash Bill Clinton and Obama did, forcing them to settle for culture war kerfuffles over Dr. Seuss and Mr. Potato Head. For the relentless Biden, the tedium is the message. I will take the second main story today. India ravaged by devastating COVID-19 surge. What happened? Fires at mass cremation grounds burned day and night in cities across India this week as the country reeled from the world's worst COVID-19 outbreak. In a single day, the Indian government reported more than 360,000 new infections, a record for any country, and some 3,300 COVID deaths. But health experts said the true counts could be up to five times higher because overwhelmed hospitals, which are suffering shortages of beds, oxygen, and medicine, are turning many patients away. I have never felt so desperate or helpless, said Tripti Gilada, a doctor at a Mumbai hospital. With less than 10% of India's 1.4 billion people having received one dose of a coronavirus vaccine, President Biden this week pledged to send the country raw vaccine materials, COVID test kits, ventilators, and therapeutic drugs. Pending an FDA safety review, 60 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine will be distributed among countries battling raging outbreaks. In the U.S., the FDA lifted its pause on Johnson & Johnson's vaccine after investigating a handful of rare blood clotting cases. Officials said the one-dose shot was safe, but noted that a small minority of women of childbearing age might be at risk of developing the clots. Vaccine supply in the U.S. now exceeds demand. Some 2.7 million doses are being administered each day, down 10% in a week. With new U.S. cases dropping 24% to 54,000 a day, the Centers for Disease Control said that vaccinated people no longer need to wear masks outdoors except at crowded gatherings. What the editorial said, there is an unconscionable shortage of COVID vaccines in developing countries, said the New York Times. The U.S. and other rich nations have 16% of the world's population, but 53% of all purchased coronavirus doses. This hoarding is self-defeating. India's outbreak is being driven partly by a local double mutant strain that might be more resistant to vaccines and could undo our own inoculation efforts if it spreads abroad. The Biden administration should call on Pfizer and other firms to suspend their vaccine patents, allowing their life-saving shots to be manufactured everywhere. The U.S. has a different vaccine problem, said NationalReview.com, a shortage of willing recipients. About 8% of Americans who got a first dose of Pfizer or Moderna skipped their second dose, sometimes out of fear that the shot's fleeting flu-like side effects. And thanks to the misguided J&J pause, only 22% of the unvaccinated now say they'd be willing to get the one-and-done shot. Vaccination is our ticket out of the pandemic, but with only 30% of Americans fully inoculated, we have a long way to go. What the columnist said. If only the U.S. were more like Israel, said Noah Smith and noopinionsubstack.com. COVID cases plummeted there after half of the population was fully vaccinated. But we will struggle to hit that vaccination level because 21% of American adults say they definitely won't get a shot, including 32% of Republicans, and many others are wavering. For some resistors, refusing a vaccine is a way of exercising personal independence after a plague year that made us impotent in the face of forces beyond our control. It's understandable that many people distrust the pronouncements of health officials, said Philip Klein in NationalReview.com. Just look at the CDC's new mask advisory, which is unmoored from science or reason. We've known for months that the risk of outdoor transmission of COVID was low to non-existent. Yet while the CDC says you now don't need to wear a mask when dining with friends at outdoor restaurants, it says you will still have to wear one at outdoor sporting events and concerts. This nonsense so-called guidance is a joke. Let's call vaccine holdouts what they really are. Free riders, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. They want to enjoy the positive result of other people rolling up their sleeves, lower transmission of the virus, and eventual herd protection, without getting inoculated themselves because of inconvenience, needle fears, and a vague sense of personal risk. The problem is that when lots of people realize they can become free riders, that public good is destroyed. The return of normal life can be achieved only when we act together. We're on the briefing page, title this week, Police Traffic Stops and Racism. As social justice advocates target police violence against people of color, traffic stops are under growing scrutiny. Why are traffic stops important? Scores of studies have shown the same pervasive pattern. Black people are more likely to be pulled over for traffic violations and more likely to be searched when they're stopped. The most comprehensive study of the issue comes from Stanford University's Open Policing Project, which in 2020 found persistent racial bias in nearly 100 million police stops made by 21 state agencies and 35 municipal departments. Tellingly, the racial disparity dropped after sunset, when it's harder for an officer to see a driver's face. Black drivers were searched about twice as often as white drivers, even though they were less frequently found to be carrying contraband. Driving while black is very much a thing, said Kelsey Schaub, an assistant professor at the University of South Carolina and co-author of Suspect Citizens, a book analyzing 20 million traffic stops. It appears to be more systemic than a few bad apple officers engaged in racial profiling. How strong is evidence for that charge? Multiple studies have come to the same conclusion. An ABC News analysis of data from city police departments last year, for example, found stark disparities in traffic stops. Blacks were stopped 5 times more in Minneapolis, 4 times more in Chicago and San Francisco, and 3 times more in Philadelphia and Los Angeles. A 2020 study of 1.8 million stops in California found blacks were 3 times more likely to be searched, a figure that matched a 2013 Justice Department study. Schaub and two colleagues found that just by getting in a car, a black driver has about twice the odds of being pulled over and about 4 times the odds of being searched. What is the impact of the stops? Traffic stops are the most common interaction between citizens and police, with some 50,000 drivers pulled over daily, about 20 million stops a year. Police have a huge amount of discretion in deciding whom to pull over, and people of color are often singled out for scrutiny and harassment. Critics say stops over matters like broken taillights are generally a pretext to interrogate or search someone or their vehicle. Many black Americans say repeated traffic stops breed humiliation, trauma, and distrust of police. There's a tension that has been growing for decades, said Senator Tim Scott, Republican from South Carolina, a conservative African-American who has spoken of the anguish he's experienced during a host of groundless traffic stops dating to his teens. More troubling still is that many of the most notorious recent police killings of black men began with traffic stops. Why is that? Police are trained to believe that every citizen they pull over may be an armed criminal. So some cops approach stops with adrenalized fear and hair trigger aggression. Consider the case of Army Lieutenant Karan Nazario, who was approached by two cops pointing guns and pepper sprayed in the face after a December traffic stop. Minnesotan Philando Castile was fatally shot with 5 bullets in front of his girlfriend and 4-year-old daughter after being pulled over for a broken taillight. An NPR analysis showed the dreadlocked 32-year-old had been stopped 46 times over 14 years. Walter Scott, a South Carolina forklift operator, was fatally shot in the back in 2015 after being stopped for a faulty brake light. Sandra Bland, 28, died in jail in Texas after being pulled over for failing to use a turn signal. In 2015, more than 100 people were fatally shot after traffic stops. The Washington Post found a third of them black. Blacks make up about 13% of the population. What's being done about this? Some critics in states are putting restrictions on when police can pull people over. A new law in Virginia prevents police from pulling over drivers solely because of minor violations. The Oregon Supreme Court ruled in 2019 that police can't interrogate drivers about matters unrelated to the reason they were stopped. And San Francisco's district attorney announced last year that the city would no longer prosecute cases arising from pretextual stops. Such moves are staunchly opposed by police unions who say traffic stops help cops find and catch serious criminals. It's a very valuable tool, said Kevin Lawrence of the Texas Municipal Police Association. But some critics of the stop want to take traffic enforcement away from police entirely. How would that work? Municipalities would create a separate agency responsible for traffic issues, staffed by unarmed agents without the power to arrest or conduct searches. Cameras would be used to target violations like expired registrations, as well as speeding and red light running. Last year, Berkeley, California became the first city to approve such a plan. Such an approach would do much to alleviate the racial injustice around traffic enforcement, said Jordan Blair Woods, a University of Arkansas law professor who studied the issue. Removing police from traffic enforcement, Woods said, could also eliminate key reasons traffic stops escalate into violence. We'll be right back. got a little ahead of myself this morning and skipped over the controversy of the week. So we'll go back and pick that up. Biden's climate plan. Is it realistic? America is back in the global fight against climate change, said Ella Nielsen in Vox.com. At a virtual summit of 40 world leaders last week, President Biden made an emphatic break from the Trump era, pledging to slash U.S. net carbon emissions to 50% of their 2005 levels by 2030 and 100% by 2050, with the entire U.S. energy sector achieving net zero carbon emissions by 2035. Biden did his best to make his plan sound like a win-win for the American people, calling it an extraordinary engine of job creation and economic opportunity. That's unlikely to persuade hostile Republicans, however, and though Biden could nibble away at U.S. carbon emissions through executive orders, the greatest challenge his plan faces is that he needs Congress to pass it. Experts say that achieving such dramatic cuts in emissions will also require rapid and sweeping changes to virtually every corner of the nation's economy, said Brad Plumer in the New York Times. Coal fuel power plants, already a declining source of energy, will need to shut down. The number of wind turbines and solar arrays would need to quadruple. Most new cars will have to be electric. It's all achievable in theory, but success will mean a very different America. Thanks, but no thanks, said David Harsanyi in NationalReview.com. With 80% of our current energy coming from fossil fuels, Biden's vision would mean a precipitous drop in the living standards of most citizens. The cost of retrofitting every home, factory, warehouse, and building in America to run on electricity would cripple our economy. We'd then need to envelop most of the nation in panels and windmills, presumably relying on Gaian prayer circles to ensure enough sunshine and wind to keep our country running. Even in the unlikely event the U.S. could meet Biden's target, said Rich Lowry in Politico.com, China, India, and other countries will merely pretend to go along. Who's going to hold China accountable for its climate pledges, and how, precisely? Nonsense, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. The cost of wind and solar power are already competitive with fossil fuels, thanks to an extraordinary innovation cycle that makes them cheaper every year. As usual, conservatives are responding to the climate crisis with misinformation and a dismissive attitude toward doing anything. In a perfect illustration of the conservative position, said Molly Roberts in WashingtonPost.com, right-wing media and Republican officials this week hysterically informed their followers that Biden's plan requires Americans to reduce their red meat consumption by 90%, a lie that originated on the trashy Daily Mail website. Rather than have constructive input on a vital issue, the unserious right prefers to serve nothing burgers. That may be changing, said Rebecca Lieber in Vox.com. Republicans will never support such a moonshot plan for a Democratic president. But there's a growing realization among GOP leaders that climate denial and foot dragging are poor politics, especially when it comes to appealing to a younger conservative base that knows the climate crisis is real and will have to live with it. The consequences of a changing climate are already visible and undeniable, said Jeffrey Sachs in CNN.com. As last week's summit demonstrated, the world's major economies are all finally aligning around the goal of deep decarbonization. It will take enormous efforts and ingenuity to get to net zero carbon emissions by 2050, but the debate over whether we need to is largely over. Here's our good week, bad week feature. It was a good week for refills, with the new research from Portugal's University of Minho that people who drink between 3 and 5 daily cups of coffee have more efficient brains and exhibit increased levels of attention and alertness and improved motor control. It was a good week for risk management after the mayor of Pamplona, Spain, canceled the annual Running of the Bulls festival for the second year in a row because of the pandemic. In the interest of public health, no one will have the opportunity of being gored or trampled by bulls on Pamplona's cobbled streets until at least 2022. And it was a good week for tributes after John Hinkle Jr., 39, of Illinois, bowled a perfect game using a bowling ball filled with his father's ashes. "I had tears in my eyes in the 11th and 12th frame," said Hinkle. But it was a bad week for revisionist history after former Republican presidential candidate Rick Santorum told a crowd of college students that there was nothing here before the arrival of white Europeans. "I mean, yes, we have Native Americans," he added, "but candidly, there isn't much Native American culture in American culture." It was a bad week for the bar menu, with reports of a chicken wing shortage across the U.S. "Wing supplies are tight," conceded Tom Super of the National Chicken Council, eschewing the alarming word shortage. Finally, it was a bad week for liberty after Fox News host Tucker Carlson advised his viewers that if they see a child wearing a face mask while playing outside, they are morally obligated to attempt to prevent it and should, in fact, call the police immediately, contact Child Protective Services, and keep calling until someone arrives. There's a short news piece before we move on. House passes D.C. statehood bill. The House of Representatives voted along party lines last week to make Washington, D.C. the 51st state. Under the measure, which has slim chance of passing in the Senate without a repeal of the filibuster, most of the district would turn into a new state to be called Washington Douglas Commonwealth, named in honor of 19th century civil rights leader Frederick Douglass. A small area encompassing the Capitol, the White House, the National Mall, and some government buildings would stay under federal control. Statehood would likely create two safe Democratic seats in the Senate and one in the House. Democrats say the bill would correct the disenfranchisement of the district's 700,000 citizens, but the GOP has branded it a power grab. Read a few of the best columns of the week. First one is from David Brooks at the New York Times. Embracing apocalyptic nihilism. Those of us who had hoped America would calm down when we no longer had Donald Trump spewing poison from the Oval Office have been sadly disabused, said David Brooks. The Trumpian Republican base have actually grown more radical without their hero in the White House to protect them, and have decided their America is facing a cultural and political Armageddon. To stave off a multiracial socialist nightmare, Trumpists believe, anything is justified, including authoritarianism and violence. In an Economist YouGov poll, two-thirds of Trump voters chose this statement as representative of their worldview. Our lives are threatened by terrorists, criminals, and illegal immigrants, and our priority should be to protect ourselves. In this mindset, the January 6th insurrection was not a shocking attempt to overturn a Democratic election, but practice for the war ahead. Most elected Republicans are indulging the base's delusional beliefs about the 2020 election, COVID denialism, and white grievance. Those who don't are attacked as traitors and barraged with death threats. Beware, history shows us that when a country is gripped by apocalyptic pessimism, people turn to the strong man to salve the darkness and chaos inside themselves. This is from an editorial in the Wall Street Journal. Portland's painful lesson. A well-known politician just denounced what he called self-described anarchists who engage in regular criminal destruction and called on the public for help to take the city back. No, said the Wall Street Journal, it was not Donald Trump. It was uber-progressive Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler, who has become the classic liberal mugged by reality. In Portland's case, the reality is an endless war in the streets between rioting leftist activists and the police. When Donald Trump was president, Wheeler defended the black-clad, masked protesters' right to demonstrate against injustice. But after George Floyd's murder, there were more than 100 consecutive days of rioting and violence. Last week, about 80 people protesting at a police precinct smashed the windows of a Boys and Girls Club across the street. A local church, a Starbucks, a concert hall, and the Oregon Historical Society were also vandalized. A fed-up Wheeler now is asking residents to help identify the rioters, saying, "Our job is to unmask them, arrest them, and prosecute them." You think? Murders in Portland were up 60% in 2020, while shootings more than doubled. As Wheeler and Portland have now learned, tolerance for lawbreaking begets more of it. This comes from Europe. Europe fighting the Americanization of soccer. Europe's richest soccer clubs have failed in their attempt to form a cartel, said Jonathan Liu in The Guardian. And we can all rejoice and revel in this triumph of popular will over the cold hand of big commerce. The planned European Super League was the antithesis of the meritocratic system that each year elevates the best performing domestic teams into the continent-wide Champions League. A closed competition featuring a dirty dozen of Europe's wealthiest teams, including Manchester United, Chelsea, Arsenal, Real Madrid, and AC Milan, the Super League would have attracted a massive global viewership and made gobs of monies for the team's billionaire owners. But the midweek tournament would have eaten into teams' domestic schedules and deprived smaller clubs of crucial revenue. So governments and fans across Europe reacted with fury. Thousands gathered outside Chelsea Stadium, waving signs reading, "Created by the poor, stolen by the rich." And, "Are three yachts not enough, Roman?" A reference to the West London team's owner, Russian billionaire Roman Abramovich, just 2 days after it was announced the league collapsed. To avoid any future breakaway attempt, the greedy teams must be punished with eye-watering fines or even suspensions. Having teams compete in a closed league is the norm in American sports, said The Economist. For Europeans, the idea is heresy. Here, domestic teams must win their way into the top leagues and tournaments and then must prove they deserve to remain there. While U.S. football franchises stay in the NFL forever, scrappy English or Spanish soccer clubs can rise up from lower leagues and star teams can fall from premier leagues if they have a bad season. European soccer rewards excellence, and it is fiercely local. Liverpool's main rival, for example, is not Manchester but Everton, whose stadium is a mile from its own. Local supporters knew that the Super League was designed not for them, but for millions of foreign fans in Asia and America who care less about such details. The Super League didn't take into account history, tradition, love, said Stefano Agresti in CalcioMercato.com. How much enthusiasm could Juventus fans muster if their team played 1 week against Arsenal and the next against Barcelona? Where is the rivalry? Where is the story? The scheme died this time, but the NFLization of European soccer is surely coming, said Oliver Fritsch in Die Zeit. Some teams have simply outgrown the competition in their home leagues. Juventus, for example, has topped Italy's Serie A league 9 years in a row. Paris Saint-Germain has won France's Ligue 1 title 7 times in 8 years. And Bayern Munich is aiming for its 9th German championship. Money is always going to distort the game, said the Observer. Fans want oligarch or oil chic owners willing to spend lavishly on the best players. Juventus stars striker Cristiano Ronaldo, at least $60 million a year. And when that doesn't work, to spend some more. Even without the Super League, the playing field will never be level. It's time for our in-depth article, The Last Word. The title this week is The Kneeling Girl. Marianne Vecchio spent her life trying to escape the moment she came to embody the terror of the Kent State shootings, said Patricia McCormick in the Washington Post. But the world wouldn't let her forget. And at the top of the article is a photograph of her kneeling over a dead student who was shot at Kent State. Last May, when Marianne Vecchio watched the video of George Floyd's dying moment, she felt herself plummet through time and space to a day almost exactly 50 years earlier. On that afternoon in 1970, the world was just as riveted by an image that showed the life draining out of a young man on the ground. This one, a black and white still photo. Marianne was at the center of that photo, her arms raised and anguished, begging for help. The photo of her kneeling over the body of Kent State University student Jeffrey Miller is one of the most important images of the 20th century. Taken by student photographer John Filo, it captures Marianne's raw grief and disbelief at the realization that the nation's soldiers had just fired at its own children. The Kent State Pietà, as it's sometimes called, is one of those rare photos that fundamentally changed the way we see ourselves and the world around us. These images shocked our collective conscience and insisted that we look. But eventually we look away, unaware or perhaps unwilling to think about the suffering that went on long after the shutter snapped, or the cost to the human beings trapped inside those photos. That picture hijacked my life, said Marianne, now 65. And 50 years later, I still haven't really moved on. Marianne has granted few interviews in the 25 years, and as a child of the 60s, with her own entanglement with the FBI, she's still a bit wary. Partway through the first of what would go on to be a dozen interviews over the phone, she stops abruptly. She wants to know if I'm working with law enforcement. When you've lived the life I have, she says, you still worry that many people are after you. She also tells me she's researched me before agreeing to speak. I'm a little FBI-ish myself, in a renegade way, she says, and I'm also still that hippie kid who always sees a rainbow. Before Kent State, she says, she was a free spirit. I was the kid rolling down the river on a raft, she recalls. I was magic. In my childhood, I believed anything was possible. But her home in Opa-locka, Florida, where her father was a carpenter, could be volatile. Soon she got in trouble, smoking pot, skipping school. So in February 1970, when the police told Marianne, then 14, that they'd throw her in jail if they caught her playing hooky again, she took off, in her bare feet. She says she wasn't rebelling against her parents' authority or seeking to join the anti-war movement. I just wanted to be anywhere that wasn't Opa-locka. Hitchhiking her way across the country, Marianne slept in fields, at hamburger shacks, at crash pads. Eventually, she got to Kent State, northern Ohio, where, on May 4th, student protest erupted over President Richard Nixon's decision to invade Cambodia. Marianne, in her jeans, white scarf, and a pair of hippie sandals someone had given her, headed toward a field where students were gathered. On her way to join the protests, she struck up a conversation with a guy in bell-bottoms. The two of them watched as another student waved a black flag, taunting the National Guard troops who had been sent in after protesters had burned down the ROTC building two nights before. The soldiers seemed to retreat to a nearby hill. Then, in the next 13 seconds, they fired more than 60 shots. Marianne dropped to the pavement and waited until the smoke cleared to look up. Jeffrey Miller, the student she'd been talking to, was face down on the ground. He'd been shot through the mouth. She knelt over his body as blood seeped onto the pavement. Other students walked by, too stunned or confused to look. "Doesn't anyone see what just happened here?" she remembers crying. "Why is no one trying to help him?" As the soldiers approached, she recalls asking them a question that countless others across the country would soon ask as well. "Why did you do this?" Nearby were more bodies. Allison Krauss was shot in the chest, William Schroeder in the back. Sandy Shore, who was just passing through the area on her way to a class, was struck by a bullet that hit her jugular vein. Four dead in Ohio. John Philo was a senior at Kent State in May 1970, a student photographer who almost missed out on covering the protest because he'd been in the woods taking pictures of tea berry leaves for his senior thesis that weekend. All the other photographers on the student paper had assignments from out-of-town papers, so John, 21, was working in the newspaper office to help process their pictures. On his lunch break, he grabbed a camera and went outside, heading straight toward the action, where a student in the no man's land between soldiers and students waved a black flag. John snapped a photo, thinking, "Okay, I've got my picture." A moment later, the soldiers formed a rifle line. "I put my camera to my eye and trained it on one of the soldiers," he said. "He aimed toward me, and then his gun goes off. The next thing I know, a bullet hits a tree near me and a chunk of bark flew off." John dropped to the ground and waited out the 13 seconds of gunfire. When the smoke cleared, he stood and patted his arms and legs, checking to see if he'd been hit. "It was like slow motion. I just kept wondering, how come I'm not shot?" Then, not 10 feet away, he saw a body on the ground. John was running out of film as he saw a girl kneel beside the body. "I knew the boy was dead, but I couldn't tell she didn't know. But I could tell she didn't know," he told me. "I could see something building her, and all of a sudden she lets out this scream, and I shoot. I shoot one more picture, and I'm out of film." By the time he had reloaded his camera, the girl was gone. John ran to his car. After hiding the film inside a hubcap, he drove for 2 hours to the office of his hometown newspaper in western Pennsylvania to process his film. When he called the Associated Press from the newsroom of the Valley Daily News of Tarentum, he was told the news service had plenty of Kent State photos coming from its bureaus in Akron, Ohio, and that its entire wire capacity was being used to transmit these photos. But when there was an unexpected break in the transmissions from Akron, John jumped on the wire and sent his photo. His image of the grieving girl ran on the front pages of newspapers all over the world the next day. The caption identified her simply as a co-ed. The days after the shooting went by in a haze for Marianne. National Guard troops were herding students onto buses bound for Columbus. So she followed in a daze. She hitchhiked out, drifting west and sleeping wherever she could. She had heard she was wanted by the FBI, so she didn't tell anyone who she was. She wound up at a crash pad in Indianapolis, thinking that if she could just get to California, she could start her life over again. But a kid at the house where she was staying recognized her and tipped off the Indianapolis Star. Marianne, barely disguised in a granny gown and fake glasses, talked to the reporter, hoping he'd give her bus fare to California. The reporter got his scoop, then called the authorities, who put her in juvenile detention as a runaway. Within days, she was back home. Many people refused to believe the nearly 6-foot-tall girl with the long flowing hair and the mournful face was only 14. Her family received calls and letters calling her a drug addict, a tramp, a communist. The governor of Florida said she was part of a nationally organized conspiracy of professional agitators. Back in Kent, Ohio, some residents raised four fingers when they passed each other in the street, a silent signal that meant at least we got four of them. Meanwhile, in Opa-locka, death threats filled the Vecchio family mailbox. It's too bad it wasn't you that was shot. What you need is a good beating until you bleed red. I hope you enjoyed sleeping with all those Negroes and dope fiends. She ran away from home again and got caught, ending up in juvenile detention. Later in 1977, Marianne was profiled by 60 Minutes as a maladjusted kid. For the segment, she read aloud from the hateful letters she'd received, which were spread out on her parents' dining table. Morley Safer said she wasn't a symbol of the tragedy of the Vietnam War. She wasn't a symbol of anything. Just a 14-year-old nobody hitchhiking from nowhere to nowhere. He seemed to take smug satisfaction in the trouble she had after Kent State. Everyone had a piece of me, Marianne said. And when everyone in the world thinks they know who you are, you don't want to be who you are. Eventually, at age 22, Marianne took off from Florida, moved to Las Vegas, married, and got a job in a casino coffee shop. She was rarely mentioned in news stories commemorating the events of May 4, 1970. In May 1990, she told the Orlando Sentinel that the photograph had really destroyed my life. By that time, she'd also learned it was risky to tell people that she was the girl in the iconic photo. The less I said, the safer I felt, she recalls. John Filo's picture would win a Pulitzer Prize, but he too was haunted. I felt very guilty, he says. An arm's length to my right, a guy was shot. An arm's length or two to my left, that's where Jeffrey Miller was killed. I'm alive and I'm relatively famous, and they're dead. When he read that the police had been harassing Marianne, he felt responsible. John went on to have a successful career as a photographer. Today he's the head of photography for CBS. He says that not a day went by that he didn't think about the Kent State students or Marianne. Sometimes he had nightmares about her. When he became a father and looked in his daughter's eyes, he saw Marianne's eyes. John and Marianne finally met in 1995 at a 25-year retrospective on Kent State and Mississippi's Jackson State, where students had been shot and killed by police around the same time. I was kind of mad at John for a long time, Marianne said. He's lucky. He's done very well. He's got a nice house. He's got everything. He got the pony. She laughs at that. I got the crap. John says he dreaded the meeting, but Marianne surprised everyone. I saw the anguish in his eyes, she said of John. And you know, I felt sorry for him. She smiled, took his hand, and hugged him. They both cried. Marianne lived in Las Vegas for nearly 20 years, moving up from her job in the coffee shop to the casino floor. She says she dreamed of being a lawyer, but something told her, don't get too successful, don't get too visible, don't be too happy. Hiding was much safer, she says. In 2001, however, she took the story of her life back into her own hands. She ended an unhappy marriage and started over again by returning to Florida. She bought a 24-foot camper, worked full-time at the Trump Spa at Doral, enrolled in nearby Miami-Dade Community College, and studied to be a respiratory therapist. Between shifts and classes, she spent time nursing her dying mother. After school, the woman who perhaps had been the most visible symbol of protest against the Vietnam War worked at the Miami VA hospital, where she cared for men who'd served at the war in the war. But she never told them she was the girl from the Kent State photo. Sometimes, she says, she wanted to tell the veterans who she was so she could explain that the protesters weren't anti-soldier, just anti-war. Nowadays, the girl who wanted to be anywhere but Opa-locka lives not far from there. No one knows her as the girl from the photo. No one follows her or sends her hate mail, though once in a while she gets an autograph request with a faraway address. She leads a quiet life, growing avocados and oranges on a small plot at the edge of the Florida Everglades. Last year, however, when she watched the video of George Floyd's death, She was so shaken, it was as if the electronic scrim of her TV had dissolved. She jumped off her couch and yelled at the crowd in the video, "Why is no one helping him?" A version of this article originally appeared in the Washington Post. We're on the Talking Points page. We'll start with an article titled, "The Pandemic, Dreading a Return to Normal." As newly vaccinated Americans emerge from hibernation and life creeps back toward normalcy, many Americans harbor a secret, said Kelly Kennedy in the Associated Press. They're not ready. Instead of joy at the thought of returning to public spaces and reconnecting with others, they're secretly dreading each milestone toward normalcy, repelled by the thought of anxiety-inducing crowds and awkward catch-up conversations. Mental health professionals call it re-entry fear, or cave syndrome, as one Florida psychiatrist dubbed it. And it's affecting not just introverts, but plenty of people who used to enjoy socializing, but now feel like they've forgotten how. In a recent survey by the American Psychological Association, 49% of adults said they feel unease at returning to in-person interactions. "We were forced into isolation," said newly minted sociophobe Nicole Russell of Miami, "and now we've grown accustomed to it." It's not just social anxiety that's prompting ambivalence about a return to pre-pandemic life, said Christine Coe in the Washington Post. For people whose old lives were ruled by packed schedules, draining commutes, and long office hours, life on lockdown served up the ultimate reset. Many reveled in the slower pace and the time to connect with families, and now they're not anxious to go back to the overstuffed lives. For others, the safety regimens that have dictated life for over a year aren't easily abandoned, said Elizabeth Chuck at NBCNews.com. With renegade variants in the news, some cannot shake the fear that they may still get the coronavirus even after receiving highly effective doses, vaccines. For those with lingering fears of the virus, peace of mind might come by reentering society gradually, said Deborah Netburn in Los Angeles Times. Instead of getting on mass transit or going to a crowded indoor restaurant, start with something relatively easy, like a backyard gathering or an outdoor dinner. The same goes for those with social fears, said Andy Tangle and Claire Marie and Schneider in NPR.org. Set realistic boundaries and pace yourself by limiting activities and carving out quiet time. Rest assured that life outside the cave will feel normal again, even if it takes a while. After all, humans were built to socialize. 15 months of lockdown may have you feeling rusty, but in the grand scheme of things, said communication expert Celeste Headley, you have 300,000 years of evolution helping you to do this. Read a few of the shorter notes. The Pentagon warned the House Armed Services Committee that the risk of mysterious directed energy attacks against U.S. troops and diplomats is on the rise, and that the technology behind them most likely comes from Russia. The attacks cause ringing in the ears, fatigue, headaches, and loss of balance, and in some cases, long-term brain damage. The U.S. has recorded only about 2,000 flu cases since September, compared with the usual average of 206,000 cases. The lack of exposure could mean the next flu season will be worse, but it's also possible the virus will be milder because it didn't evolve. We're in uncharted territory, said a virologist. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office will no longer prosecute sex workers, following similar decisions by Baltimore and Philadelphia. Prosecuting these workers does not make us safer, said Prosecutor Cyrus Vance Jr., who asked a judge to dismiss 914 cases of prostitution and unlicensed massage. attempting to capitalize on the U.S. Supreme Court's new 6-3 conservative majority, state lawmakers across the country have introduced about 500 measures so far this year to curtail a woman's right to an abortion. Some bills would prohibit abortions based on genetic abnormalities, while others would prevent doctors from prescribing abortion pills through telemedicine visits or allow men with paternity claims to block abortions. On the poll watch, 71% of Americans think we all have more common ground than is portrayed in the news. 61% have had constructive conversations with those who hold differing political views, and 93% think we need to reduce divisiveness. And we'll finish out with a quote today. This comes from philosopher Bertrand Russell, quoted in Goodreads.com. He says, "One of the symptoms of an approaching nervous breakdown is the belief that one's work is terribly important." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.